Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Well, buenos días. Welcome everyone. Well, thank you really very much for coming to listen to me. You know, a lot of what I'm going to say today is about our duty as democratic citizens to learn economics, and I hope I can convince you. This book, its original title is Economics, the User's Guide. But my Spanish publisher, Mondadori, made it into Economics for 99% of the population. Now, this is a great title, but, you know, I also want the remaining 1% to read it too, you know. Because that they need to really understand that, what they are doing wrong. Now, you know, when you talk to people who are not economists, most of them agree that, yes, economics is very important, you know. A lot of what happens in our lives are determined by economic policies, you know, government monetary policy, pension policy, labor policy. But people then say, but, you know, economics is really too complicated. It's not for me, it's for specialists. I don't have a strong opinion, you know, let the specialists deal with it. But when you think about it, this is a very strange thing. Because people have strong opinions on all kinds of things without having the expertise. You know, I bet, like I do, you have very strong views on, you know, American policy in the Middle East, nuclear energy, you know, gay marriage, climate change. Yeah, I have a very strong view on American foreign policy in the Middle East. But what do I know about international politics? I took one course in international politics when I was an undergraduate student in South Korea in 1983, and my professor used textbooks from the 1960s. He was an old man. Yeah, so what little I know about international politics is at least 50 years old. But I don't see any problem in saying, oh, the Americans shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that, you know, Israel should do this, shouldn't do this. And I bet it's a lot like that for you as well, yeah? You know, you have very strong views on, you know, international politics, you know, religion, climate change. But when it comes to economics, a lot of people say, oh, but, you know, I don't know enough to comment on it. Why? Why should economics be different? Well, it's different because my professional colleagues have been fantastically successful in making people believe that the subject is so difficult that they cannot understand it even if economists try to explain it to them. Yes, they've scared you off. But I believe that, and I said it in my previous book called 23 Things That They Don't Tell You About Capitalism, which is also published by the same Spanish publisher, Mondadori. I said that 95% of economics is actually common sense. Of course, made to look difficult, because economists use a lot of mathematics, a lot of very technical language. And when ordinary people try to read it, they get headache. But actually, the ideas behind all this, you know, 95% of them are no more than common sense. And yes, I mean, there's 5% that is more than a common sense, but you know, these things can be understood if someone tries to explain it in a user-friendly way, which is the whole idea of this book. So in order to make it user-friendly, I use all the tricks that I can think of. So there's, you know, lots of things in the book. I mean, you think that, yes, it's a book about economics, and of course there might be a reference to the movie Wall Street, but there's also Mary Poppins, The Simpsons, Big Bang Theory, even the Scarlett Johansson. Well, unfortunately, there's no picture of her in the book. I'm sorry to tell you her male fans. But yes, I mean, she's there. So, you know, I really try my best. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that I have completely succeeded, but, you know, with the help of all these things, I'm trying to make economics something that you don't feel afraid to talk about. No? But trying to make economics accessible doesn't mean that I'm trying to give my reader some kind of baby version of economics, you know, dummy's guide to economics, yeah? Six things that you have to know about economics. No, it's not like that. Because I take my readers very seriously, and I talk about all kinds of fundamental issues, like whether economics can be a science, whether economics and politics can be separated, what are the ethical foundations of economics, how there are many different ways of theorizing about the economy and why they matter. And these are all very kind of heavy issues, but I try to explain them in a way that is accessible to everyone. I mean, okay, I mean, probably you need that secondary education to understand what's going on here, but as far as you have that, I assure you that you will understand, yeah, what I say in the book. So the book has a lot of things that you don't normally see in the standard introductory economics books. I mean, things that economists think ordinary people cannot really understand is too profound or too difficult. Yeah? So I talk about, you know, the definition of economics, economic history in chapters 2 and 3, you know, basically how capitalism has developed. Chapter 4 talks about the different types of economics and what their respective strengths and weaknesses are. And then I also talk about some obvious topics like, you know, finance, inequality, and so on, but also some things that economists don't usually talk about, like work. You know, work is a very interesting subject, which I'll talk about later, if I have time. But, you know, in economics, work is talked about only when it's not there, when there's unemployment. Yeah, we talk a lot about unemployment, but we don't talk about work itself very much. Yeah. So I try to talk about things like that. I mean, obviously, it covers a lot of things. I cannot talk about everything, but, you know, I try to give a broad overview. Another interesting feature, I would say, of my book is that it talks a lot about what I call real-life numbers. You know, a lot of people think economics is a numbers subject. And indeed, when you look at economics books, there are lots of numbers. But this doesn't mean that actually economists really know numbers about the real world economy. So today, it is very common for someone to graduate from an economics degree without knowing even what the national output of their own country is. Yeah? You know, in the case of Colombia, it's that, well, I looked it up. I mean, is that about $380 billion, which means that the size of the Colombian economy is basically the size of a middle-sized American state, like Minnesota or Washington. Yeah? The world economy as a whole is something like at $78 trillion, which means that, you know, Colombia is not even 0.5% of the world economy. You know, people talk a lot about the growing importance of China, but they normally don't have any idea how important it is or how big it is. I mean, today accounts for about 13% of the world economy, which is still only about half of the United States, which is something like 23%, yeah? And so on. Yeah? So I give a lot of these numbers in the book. Of course, in this internet age, you don't need to remember any of these numbers. Eh? You need to remember only one thing, Google. Yeah? Yes, you can look these things up anytime, yeah, anywhere. But I try to give these numbers because it is important to have some feel about what these numbers look like, even just to want to look up these numbers. Yeah? And when you get these numbers wrong, you can make a big mistake. Yeah? Let me give you just one example. You know, during the height of the crisis in the Eurozone, especially Greece was a big problem. And there was this very widespread narrative coming out of Germany, the Netherlands, and other kind of richer northern European countries, where it was said, you know, Greeks, they are in economic trouble because they don't work hard. Huh? I mean, they borrow money like the Germans, and then they don't work, they work like the Greeks, yeah? They don't work hard, you know, they borrow money, and of course they are in trouble, yeah? So the Germans started giving this lectures on basically morality, yeah? You are bad people, yeah? You should work harder. But did you know that the Greeks actually work 30% longer than the Germans? 40% longer than the Dutch, who are actually officially the laziest people in the world? No, they have the shortest working hour in the world. Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not criticizing them. Actually, I like it. You know, why should you work all the time like my fellow Koreans do? Huh? Yeah, you should enjoy your life. Yeah? But the fact remains that Germans, the Dutch, they don't work as hard as the Greeks. Yeah? Of course, by saying this, I'm not saying that there's nothing wrong with Greece. There are lots of things that are wrong with Greece, but it's not people being lazy. It's not work ethic. What is wrong with Greece is low productivity. Huh? So actually, the European Union should have discussed how you are going to raise productivity in Greece. Yeah? So how do you invest in research and development? How do you encourage innovation? Yeah? How do you invest in infrastructure to help enterprises raise their productivity? How do you invest in worker training? None of this was discussed because people operated with this vague idea that Greeks don't work hard. Yeah? So everything became about work ethic, morality, responsibility. You know, this is just one example, but there are so many things that people think in the wrong way because they don't know what the reality is. Of course, while emphasizing the importance of real-life numbers, I emphasize how numbers always need to be taken with caution. So as Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the German writer, of Faust, he was actually some sort of scientist as well. So he, in one of his scientific works, wrote that everything factual is already a theory. Because facts are manufactured on the basis of some theory. Yeah, so let's take the most widely used number in the economics, the GDP. This is gross domestic product, and I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but basically it means how much your economy is producing. Now, when you calculate GDP, you do not include the value of the household work and care work that is done within family. Now, this is mostly done by women. They don't get paid for it. And we say, well, since they don't get paid for it, we are not going to count it. Actually, this is enormous. I mean, if you try to pay your mother, your wife, your sister for the work they do at the market rate, you will add 30, maybe 40, possibly 50% to your national output. But this we don't count. Why? It's not for practical reason. It's not because it's impossible to estimate this. You can estimate it. And actually, when the governments collect economic statistics, they do a lot of things to put value on things that are not exchanged into the market. So for example, they would, when you rent a house from someone, you pay rent. So that's the value of the housing service that you are getting from your landlord. But if you live in your own house, you don't pay that. So, you might think, probably they don't count that. No, they do. Actually, they estimate how much money they would have got, they would have paid in order to live in a house like what they own. So this is estimated and added to GDP. So we do all kinds of things to estimate things that are not exchanged in the market. We don't include this women's work only because we assume that this is like nature, It's like air. Well, someone might want to defend this theory, but he or she has to admit that this is a theory. So you are already taking a theoretical position when you are saying that Colombia's GDP is $380 billion. It's not a natural number, like the number of, trees in the forest, or the size of the Orinoco River. These are invented numbers. So you have to be careful in accepting these numbers. Okay, let's talk about some of the other things. So the first thing I want to talk about is the definition of economics, because it's a very interesting thing. When you ask people, what do you think economics is? People who have had no education in economics will say, well, economics must be about the study of the economy. Chemistry is a study of chemicals. Biology is a study of living things. So economics must be the study of the economy. Well, I agree with that definition, but this is not what most economists would define economics as. Because most economists these days will tell you that economics is the science of everything. Yeah, it's actually quite amazing. I mean, these are some of the most popular economics books over time. So we have the book by Financial Times journalist Tim Harford, the so-called undercover economist. And this is his second book, which he gave the subtitle, The New Economics of Everything. In the middle is the famous Freakonomics book, probably the best-selling economics book of our time, which is also supposed to be about the hidden side of everything. And on the right is a book by Professor Cornell University in America called Robert Frank, who is a very modest man. He says, well, economics probably cannot explain everything, but it can explain almost everything. Yeah? Now, when the non-economists see titles like this, they'll immediately think about this. Yeah? Okay, I mean, you couldn't even explain the economy. This is why we have this huge mess in the global economy. And then now you are telling us that economists can explain everything. And you must have a serious case of megalomania. Huh? Yes, it is a megalomania, but it's not a simple case of megalomania, because the reason why so many economists claim that economists can explain everything is because of the way in which the dominant school of economics, dominant approach to economics, called the neoclassical school, defines economics in a very particular way. So this is a classic definition given by, well, I mean, he's been dead for some time, but a former professor of a famous London School of Economics called Lionel Robbins, who basically defined economics as a science of choice when things are scarce. Yeah? This is known as the rational choice theory. And he basically defined economics as a rational choice theory, and this definition has been accepted very widely. But the interesting thing is that this is a very strange definition of a subject, because all other subjects are defined by the field of inquiry. So as I said, chemistry studies chemicals, biology studies living things. But here, these economists are defining economics in terms of its analytical methodology, rational choice theory. It doesn't matter whether you are studying the economy or something else. The methodology itself is what defines the subject. So indeed, some of you must have read it. If you read books like Free Economics, there are actually very few things that you normally associate with economics. Yeah? There's nothing on inequality, nothing on unemployment, nothing on inflation. It's all about how Japanese sumo wrestlers cheat in order to increase their prize money, how American school teachers manufactured the student exam marks in order to get higher salary. It's not about the economy as people think. Now this is very problematic, because in other disciplines, in other subjects, the subject is defined by the objects of inquiry. So you go to a biology department, there are people doing research with all kinds of different methodologies. Yeah? So there are people doing DNA analysis, there are people doing nasty experiment with rats, there are people doing mathematical models of animal behavior, there are people studying animal bone structure as if they are structural engineers. And there are even people who fly to the jungles of Burundi, sit with the mountain gorillas, write down what they do, the whole day. But biologists don't say, well, I mean, that guy sitting with gorillas is not a biologist because he doesn't do mathematics or he doesn't do experiments. No. Biologists are smart enough to know that living organisms are complex things, and you cannot just understand them in one way. But in economics, we have this very peculiar situation where what defines the subject is how you do it. Now, this is a very important point, because one important consequence of this very particular definition of economics is to make neoclassical economists, the economists belonging to the dominant school of economics, believe that there's only one right way of doing economics. But in the book, I try to show that there are at least 9 schools of economics, and half a dozen more if you count smaller schools, newer schools. And I explain what they say, I explain how they approach our economic issues, and I try to show that each of these schools have its own unique strengths and weaknesses. There's no single school that is better than other schools. So we have, highlighted that 3 schools are there, classical, neoclassical, and Austrian, because these are 3 schools of economics which have supported free market policies. But the interesting point is that they have very different theories about how the economy works. But then they still support the same policy. You know, if it's, economics is a science in the sense of physics and chemistry, something like this cannot happen. Yeah? How can you have 3 theories that lead to the same conclusion? Now, the classical theories, of course, are the economics of Adam Smith and another important economist, David Ricardo. These people supported the free market, but their theory was completely different from neoclassical theory. Because unlike neoclassical economists who think the economies are made up of individuals, the classical economists thought that they are made up of classes. The capitalists, the workers, the landlords. And this is actually what Karl Marx took from that school. He tried to analyze how the division of the income between these different classes affected economic growth and the other things in the economy. And this comes from the classical school. So they may be equally pro-market as neoclassical economists, but they are very class-conscious. Neoclassical economists actually deny that there is such a thing as a class. We are all individuals. Another interesting thing is that the neoclassical school, even though a lot of its practitioners support free market economics, is not the same as free market economics. A good example is Joe Stiglitz, who couldn't come because of a health problem. You know, Stiglitz is a neoclassical economist, but he doesn't support free market policy. Because in one part of neoclassical economics, there's this theory called theory of market failure. There's a very good theory explaining why market may not produce the perfect result. And once you, if you believe that part of the theory, you can be neoclassical and can be in favor of a lot of government interventions, like Stiglitz is, like Krugman is, like Piketty is. There's yet another school supporting free market, well, actually even more strongly than the other schools, is the so-called Austrian school. Some of you must have heard of this name, Friedrich von Hayek. So this school is an even stronger supporter of free market, but they do not support the free market on the same logic as the other schools. So yes, the neoclassical school, the Austrian school say, individuals make up the society. There's no class. But the vision of individuals they have is very different from the vision of neoclassical economics. In neoclassical economics, we are all very rational, calculating, selfish agents. In Austrian economics, the limitations of human the intelligence is very much emphasized. The complexity and uncertainty of the world is very much emphasized. So insofar as neoclassical economy supports free market conclusions, the argument will be individuals know what they are doing. They are rational. They have good information. So the government shouldn't tell them what to do because they are acting in their own self-interest. The Austrian argument, however, will be that, yeah, individuals are stupid, but, you know, there's no one else who is smarter. This is a very different argument from neoclassical argument. I mean, personally, I find it more convincing than the neoclassical argument, but, you know, that's not the point here. I mean, there are three different schools that support the same policy in one school. Actually, there are people who are supporting completely different policies, like the neoclassical school. So my contention in the book is that we need all these different approaches to economics in order to fully explain the complex thing called the economy. And in making this argument, I give you what I call the Singapore problem, or what I call the life is stranger than fiction. You know, when you read about Singapore in the financial press, you know, I don't know, Economist Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, if you read about Singapore in standard textbooks on the economic development, they'll all tell you, well, this country succeeded because it used a free trade policy, it welcomed foreign investment, which it did. But you will never be told that 90% of land in Singapore is owned by the government. You will never be told that 85% of housing in Singapore is provided by government-owned housing corporation. You will never be told that 22% of GDP in Singapore is produced by state-owned enterprises, including the famous Singapore Airlines. So I put it to my students. Give me one economic theory, doesn't matter what it is, neoclassical, Marxist, Keynesian, give me one economic theory that can single-handedly explain the economic success of Singapore. I tell you, there is no such theory. So, I mean, of course, my argument is a little more complicated than what I can give you today, but basically in the book, I argue that we should let 100 flowers bloom. We should let all these different approaches to develop because they all have different strengths and weaknesses. They are interested in different problems. So they have developed tools to explain the different things. They have different political and ethical assumptions. So that if you want to understand a certain problem, like, I don't know, the inflation, classical economics is pretty useless, because they have a world where there's really no inflation. If you want to understand technological innovation, Keynesian school is pretty weak on that, because it is mainly interested in short-term macroeconomic factors, and so on. So, my argument is that we need to learn from all these different schools and also let them cross-fertilize. Some of these ideas can be mixed. I'm not saying that when you cross-fertilize these 9 different schools, one day you will have a unified theory of economics. I don't believe in that, because these different schools are different systems of thought. They have a different view of the world. They think the world is made up of different things. They have different assumptions about politics and culture and everything. So, you are not going to have a unified theory, but at least they could exchange some ideas and improve our understanding richer. Well, actually, some of it is already being done, but I think that we should do a lot more of that. So my advice is that you should not be a man or a woman with a hammer by learning on only one kind of theory. You know this saying that he who has a hammer sees everything as a nail and starts banging everything. Yeah? Well, that's the only tool you have, so you're going to use it in the way you know. Yeah? Well, it will be perfect if you are banging a nail. It would be kind of acceptable, although not ideal, if you are banging a screw. But if it's a rubber ball that you are banging, it will be completely ineffective. And it will be a disaster if you are banging an egg. So I say that we should get a Swiss army knife rather than a hammer. It has a lot of different tools to use for different things. And of course, you need to learn where to use what. And that requires knowledge, not just of economics, but also of politics, history, philosophy, and so on. Okay, well, I think I should skip some of the things. Throughout the book, I emphasize that economics is a political subject. A lot of economists will tell you, oh, it's a science, that it's a value-free science. We shouldn't let the ideology intervene in economics. But this is wrong. Because all economic theories have implicit political assumptions. When the neoclassical economics was first born in the late 19th century, they followed the philosophy of the so-called utilitarians. These are people like Jeremy Bentham, who basically believed that the purpose of public policy should be to maximize the happiness of the greatest number of people. But a bit later, in the early 20th century, this half Italian, half French economist called Vilfredo Pareto and some other people raised the questions about this. They said, you keep talking about the greatest happiness of the greatest number of people, but does it mean that you can then override certain individuals because that will be useful for improving the welfare of other people? You cannot do that. So to explain this a bit more intuitively, I invented this the story called One Finger Story, which goes like the following. Someone knocks at my door tomorrow morning and says, oh, Dr. Chang, we invented this wonderful technology that will solve climate change problem overnight. We have actually built the machine. It's ready to go. All we need is one tiny input, and we want you to provide that input. And I say, what is it? They say, we need one live human finger to start this machine. Well, if they say it, I'll gladly cut one of my fingers off and give it to them. I'm saving the world. But what if it's one arm? Of course I'll do it. But what if it's my life gets difficult, but what if it's a life of my whole family? What if it's a life of all 50 million Koreans? What is 50 million compared to 7 billion? So where do you stop? Before you know it, you're in the same bed with Hitler and Stalin. So Pareto and his followers said, you cannot do that. You can call a change an improvement, social improvement, only when it hurts no one. So make at least some people better off, but makes no one worse off. This is a very noble principle, trying to defend individual rights against the tyranny of the majority, and most economists have basically, most neoclassical economists have bought into this idea. So today, neoclassical economists that try to judge different options in terms of what they call Pareto improvement. So if he uses this policy, is it going to hurt anyone? If it's going to hurt even a small minority, we shouldn't do it. Yeah? And they say this is a very value-free position. It's not political. But it is actually a very political position. Yeah? You may like it or may not like it, but it is a political position. Yeah? Because what is it is implicitly saying is that you cannot change the status quo. Yeah, so let's go to the other extreme from the one finger story and take a concrete case that the African country called Equatorial Guinea. Yeah? It is one of the few countries that was colonized by the Spaniards in Africa. This country, until 1995, used to be one of the 30 poorest countries in the world. Today, it's the richest country in Africa. Per capita income of $22,000, comparable to that of South Korea and Portugal. Unfortunately, this increase in income was entirely due to finding a big oil reserve. I mean, it's a small country with only 700,000 people, so compared to the size of the country, big oil reserve. But this reserve is basically owned by the president and his friends. So for most people, life is as if nothing happened. Yeah? Okay, maybe there was some trickle down, you know. But basically, it's still a poor country, yeah? With a group of extremely wealthy people. Yeah? In that kind of context, a lot of people say, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a good thing if you can, you know, take, I don't know, 5% of income from this president's family and give it to poor people. A lot of people agree with it. But if you believe in the Pareto principle, you cannot do that because you cannot even hurt one person. You know, it's not an easy issue. It's not an easy issue because, you know, if you take it to the extreme, all ethical principles become monsters. Huh? You believe in utilitarianism, before you know it, you support Stalin. Yeah? You believe in the Pareto principle, before you know it, you are supporting the dictator of Equatorial Guinea. So I'm not saying that this is an easy choice, but whatever it is, even this allegedly value-free Pareto principle that the economists will give you in saying, oh, we shouldn't do land reform or we shouldn't do this, do that. You know, this is a very political position. But actually, I go one step further to argue that economics is political. I mean, economics is political in an even deeper sense because deciding what belongs in the domain of the market is a political exercise itself. You know, think about it. 200 years ago, you could buy and sell people in many countries. Yeah? Slavery was legal. You know, 150 years ago, if you argue that we should regulate child labor, they'll attack you by saying, you are trying to undermine the fundamental principle of a free market economy, namely the freedom of contract. You know, these children want to work, these people want to employ them. What is your problem? Huh? You know, it's not like these people kidnap these children and use them as slaves. It's a free contract. Of course, today, I mean, many people don't believe that. Yeah? Today, many people believe that the right of the children to have a childhood and education is more important than freedom of contract. Yeah? Once you accept that, there's not even a debate. Yeah? But if you don't accept that, this is the worst economic policy. Yeah? Because in many countries with young population, you know, half of the population, at least 40%, are children. So if you, in a country like that, if you say, well, the children cannot work, it will be a bit like, I don't know, the Colombian government announcing tomorrow that anyone whose national ID number ends with an odd number cannot work, you know. There'll be a riot. You know? So the point is that what can be sold, what can be bought, all these things are in the end politically determined. Yeah? Markets themselves are product of politics. So you cannot say that, well, up to here is the market, and from there is politics. Yeah? And politics cannot creep in here because this boundary has been changed all the time, largely out of political changes, largely out of changes in what people believe is morally, politically acceptable. So this is why I say in the first chapter of my last book that there is no such thing as a free market. Yeah? You know, some markets may look free, but it's only because you so totally accept the political and ethical assumptions behind that market that you fail to see them. Yeah? So very frequently what economists tell you is, when you say, oh, the government should do something to change this the undesirable outcome that market is giving to us, yeah? Economists will say, no, I mean, this boundary is sacred. Yeah? You cannot intervene in this market. But then what you should tell them is, who drew that boundary and when? Yeah? And was it all same all the time? Yeah? Of course, when you look through history, I mean, this boundary has been changed all the time. Yeah? And why has it been changed? Yeah? And ask them, tell me, I mean, why the current boundary is the right one and the other ones are wrong ones? And they cannot answer you because economists usually accept the existing boundary and then start the discussion. Yeah? Okay, so that leads me to my conclusions. Well, there are lots of things, but you know, I have a few things to show you today. So as I repeat, my book is not a dummy's guide to economics. It's not trying to tell you what to think, but how to think about the economy. But it's not even just an explanation of economic theories and facts. It's also about the role of economics in public life. Yeah? Because economics has today basically become the equivalent of Catholic theology in medieval Europe. Yeah? It's an ideology that justifies what's going on. So I have three things to tell you. First of all, never trust an economist, and that includes me. Yeah, of course, this creates a paradox that classical Greek philosophers used to love, you know. Okay, he's saying that, but, you know, we shouldn't trust him, so can we trust, yeah? I'm not a philosopher. I'll let the philosophers worry about it. But basically, what I'm trying to tell you is that professional economists do not have monopoly over the truth. It is entirely possible for people who are not professional economists to have sound judgments on economic issues, and sometimes their judgments may actually be even better than those of professional economists because professional economists tend to look at things very narrowly. They may be detached from the real world, you know, real-world people may have views that are more rooted in reality and less narrowly focused, and very often their views are more balanced, yeah, more nuanced, better. Yeah? And indeed, I would say that the willingness on the part of ordinary citizens to challenge professional economists and other experts is at the foundation of democracy. Yeah? No, just think about that. If all you have to do is to listen to the experts, what's the point of having democracy? Eh? Yeah, you just let experts elect themselves and tell you what to do. Yeah? And I'm not making up a scary story because this is exactly what happened in Greece and Italy in 2011. You know, when they had this Eurozone crisis, the European Commission said, oh, the countries like Italy, Greece, Spain, they all should implement this austerity package. Yeah? The Italians and the Greeks said, no, this is too harsh. And then what did they do? They parachuted unelected politicians, the economists, into the positions of prime ministers of these countries. Mr. Lucas Papademos in Greece, who was a former deputy governor of the European Central Bank, and Mr. the Professor Mario Monti, who was a professor of economics in Bologna, and Milano, and a commission of European Union. You know, especially Professor Monti, I mean, he's a very capable economist, very decent human being. I know him a little bit, And, give him any day over Berlusconi, I mean, who's the worst kind of politician you can imagine, But you cannot do that, This is a fundamental effrontery to democracy, But economists have become so arrogant that they think, well, we can just impose people who will do the right policies. This is very worrying. So as democratic citizens, we all have a duty to learn some economics and challenge these professional economists. And the second point, they shouldn't come together, but the second point is that in Latin, I don't speak Latin, so I'm not even trying to pretend to pronounce it. Apparently, these words are written in the city hall of Gouda in the Netherlands, the city famous for its cheese. And it says, listen even to the other side. You should have an open mind. Yeah, I'm not saying that you should not have an opinion of your own. You need to have one. But have the humility to accept that given the complexity of the world and given the necessarily partial nature of all economic theories, you should accept the possibility that your own theory may be wrong. And finally, throughout the book, even while I constantly make reform proposals, I emphasize how difficult it is to change the economic reality. Now, sometimes the difficulty is due to the active attempts by those who benefit from the status quo. They'll do lots of things to defend their interests. But the important thing about the economy is that the status quo often gets defended even without some people actively being evil. First of all, the $1, one vote rule of the market, as opposed to one person, one vote rule of the market, drastically constrains the ability of those with less money to refuse undesirable options given to them. And in this context, I'm always reminded about what this Brazilian bishop called Dom Helder Camara, one of the leaders of liberation theology in the 1960s, said. He said, when I give food to poor people, they call me a saint. But when I ask why these poor people do not have enough to eat, they call me a communist. Yeah, I think we should all become a bit of a communist. Not too much, that'll be a disaster, but you should ask questions about the underlying social order. Why are these people poor? Don't tell me that it's only because they are stupid and lazy. There are all kinds of structural problems with when people are really poor, I mean down to the level of their brain development being arrested because of poor nutrition in childhood, you know, there are all these the underlying factors, and you really need to look into them. Now, acknowledging the difficulties involved in changing the economic status quo should not make us give up the fight to create a better economy and a better society. Yes, all these changes are difficult. I mean, they are not going to be made overnight. They are not going to be made without careful planning. But in the long run, when enough people fight for them, many impossible things happen. Yeah, 200 years ago, if you're an American and argue that we should abolish slavery, the kindest description you'd got is unrealistic. Yeah, a lot of people would have thought you are crazy, because at the time, the American economy was totally dependent on exporting cotton, tobacco, and other things produced in plantations in the South. 100 years ago, a lot of countries locked up women in prison only because they asked for votes. Yeah, and actually a lot of women themselves said, oh, we don't need votes. We have our fathers and husbands and brothers to represent our views. Why do we need votes? But now that, you know, most people think it's that a ridiculous idea that only men should get votes. You know, only 25 years ago, Margaret Thatcher famously said that anyone who thinks that there is going to be a black majority government in South Africa is living in cloud cuckoo land. Well, of course, that's where she was living. But all of these things happened because people fought for them. So this is why I'm showing you this quote from Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, who said that we need to have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. Yes, I mean, you have to be realistic, you have to know, you know, how things are structured, you have to accept that these are not going to change overnight, but you have to believe that these changes can happen, will happen. So let me conclude with my favorite quote from Nelson Mandela, who said that it always seems impossible until it is done. Thank you.